All right, it is our constant mission here on the Border Patrol to stay young, relevant, hip, and really just keep pace with the youth of America. So to that end, Sam and I are going to spend the first segment together talking about how awesome it is to spend a night without your kids and actually get to sleep until 9 o'clock in the morning, yeah, which at our stage in life seems like you're sleeping until 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, the awesome part isn't necessarily the night, although that's awesome too, but it's the morning from 6:30 to 9.
It's so funny too, because you talk to somebody that's in their early 20s and they're like, oh yeah, man, on the weekends I don't roll out of bed before 11 a.m. ever. And you're just like, oh, 9 o'clock. If I wake up and I see 9 o'clock somewhere on the alarm clock, it's like,
it's an achievement.
Oh yeah. I'm gonna have energy today.
I'm in.
How are you, buddy?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing just fine. Besides the fact that I spent the weekend in Texas, and basically all of our sports teams got completely owned by the Texas teams. Yeah. So that happened. But otherwise, I'm fine. Let's give you. I like to do this. I like to give you kind of your pick.
Let's do it.
Of a variety of topics.
Okay.
You wrote a really interesting piece about Bill Snyder and the new athletics director at K-State.
Thank you.
I definitely want to spend some time talking about that and just the overall situation. I think there's a really interesting time in K-State athletics right now, so we could talk about that. We could talk about the anemic Royals offense or whatever else Royals-related you want. We can also do a little NFL draft conversation.
Yeah.
And I will also throw in, we could talk about Arsenal's amazing 2-1 victory over Manchester City that puts them in the FA Cup final. So those are your four topics. Tell me where you'd like to start.
So let's just get the Royals out of the way.
Okay.
Can we do that?
Yeah, let's rip off the Band-Aid first.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be hanging over our heads for the hour if we don't do it now.
That's true.
God, they stink.
Yeah. Okay, so we got that.
Do we need more?
Sorted out. Let's move
so,
on. No,
so
yeah,
here's the
bad,
deal
with
that offense. And this is why, like, I talk enough that people are probably sick of hearing it about how little managers matter in Major League Baseball.
Thank you.
You can shift around the batting order like Ned did the other day. You can have a hitting coach. I know some people, if it's not already started, people are going to get on Dale Swain. But he's a hitting coach that was there for the parade, so he's not
right.
An idiot. But these players need to hit. Like, there's nothing that Ned's telling Eric Hosmer to just keep hitting all these damn ground balls. Mm-hmm. Alex Gordon, I'm starting to worry about him for real. Like, I mean, if it turns out that he really does just stink now, then I was making a lot of excuses for him last year about the wrist in particular. I was convinced that wrist was just killing him and he wasn't admitting it. But he just looks lost and he just doesn't, the shift. I don't know if the shift is in his head and he's not bunting. He's done that a few times in the past. He's just not doing it now. It's like Moustakas, Perez, Kane, those guys are hitting, nobody else. Mm-hmm. And this team, like the frustrating part of it is that if you look at the rest of the division, nobody's playing that well. And you know, even as bad as the Royals are right now, they're three games back. They're still within some striking distance, but they are just absolutely taking this excellent starting pitching, crumbling into a ball and just throwing it into a flaming trash can. And that is frustrating to watch.
Should we take comfort in the fact that they've kind of been here before? I mean,
Yes. They've come back from much worse, much later. They were under 500 in like late July of 2014 and finished that season in the World Series. So like it's not like the season is shot stuff. But I don't like this would be it wouldn't be easy to look up, but we could look this up. I don't think they've had 18 games like this, where the offense I'm talking about, where the offense has looked this bad, because it sticks out because it's the beginning of the season. But we've talked about this on the show a few times. The way I like to think about these things is if you're going to freak out at the beginning of the season, just stop before you do and think, if this happened in July, August, you know, if it was just a random 18 games, would you freak out? Would you be talking about how bad the offense is? Yes, absolutely. if this happened, if the Royals had a season of being 6th, 7th, 8th in the league in offense, which I think they're capable of, but then had an 18-game stretch like this, I think we'd be talking about what in the hell is wrong with these guys hitting.
I don't remember the Royals having any stretch like this during the World Series year for sure. I mean, they got off to a red-hot start, and they just looked like a team on a mission that entire year. But so what I am remembering the most is 2013.
Uh-huh.
I do think they had stretches like this. I mean, there
18
was,
games? I mean, maybe. I'm not.
Well, I just here's, and I'll have to, maybe we can kind of look this up while we're conversing about it, and maybe Jake can do it for me, but here's what I remember about 2013. I remember I was on vacation in Denver, in Estes Park, Colorado, with my family around Labor Day. I know it was Labor Day because we, you know, that's when our family does the little Estes Park thing. Mm-hmm. And because I'm an idiot who can't divorce myself completely from my work, I was actually cooking for my family while listening to the 810 app and listening to Stephen St. John demand a house cleaning of the front office because it was year number 6 of Dayton Moore, and the team was losing games like crazy. They couldn't score any runs. I think they were in St. Louis when Dayton Moore like drove to St. Louis or whatever, and they fired the hitting coach and hired George Brett, which seemed at the time like the biggest last ditch save our jobs type move ever. And that offense was brutal, if I remember. And that was a month later into the season, and it just looked like it was all going to hell. And then the team turned around, and they didn't make the playoffs that year, but they did end up with an above 500 record, if I remember. And we were actually talking like playoff race, and you know, like what the Royals had to do to make it to the playoffs in September of that year. That's my memory. That's without me looking up the numbers. But so I'd have to feel like they were that bad offensively for some sort of a stretch. Now the negator would say, well, they didn't make the playoffs that year, so let's not. But I guess my point is that they did recover from that and at least have a winning record that year. You know, does that all sound right to you guys? I mean, my timeline, what I'm remembering there.
And I've got I can do the math in a second here. I'm looking at those games, and they were some bad games. But okay, so as it turned out, that May buried that team. They didn't make the playoffs. I mean, they recovered to win whatever it was, 86. Is that what it was?
I can't remember. I know they finished above 500. Yeah,
they won 86 games. So they recovered to have a winning season, which was only three fewer than they won the next year when they went to the World Series. But that May was so bad that it basically buried them for the playoffs. And that 86 wins meant progress for that team at that time. Missing the playoffs this year would be a disappointment for this team at this time. The frustrating part too, one of the other frustrating parts is that there's nothing left to do. They've burned the, you know, called up Merrifield, called up Bonifacio, you know, shook the lineup around a little bit. There's nothing left for those guys to do other than wait for Eric Hosmer to hit the ball in the air, wait for Alex Gordon to be the guy before last season, wait for Alcides Escobar is not a good hitter. But Merrifield can be solid. Lorenzo Cain, they need him to hit with a little bit more power too. I know his average is high, and he's getting on base and those things. But they need some power out of him if it's not coming from anywhere else. They because at some point those starting pitchers, we always talk about, you know, starting pitchers. You don't want them to feel like they have to be perfect every time when the offense stinks. I think there's a little bit of like, you know, at some point. Christ, like what am I doing this for? You know, why am I going 7 and giving up one if we're going to lose 2-1 in 13 innings or whatever? You know, they're in a bad way right now. But they have, you know, this is a group, you know, you can question a lot of things about this group. One thing you can't question is their resiliency and their belief and their ability to dig their way out of situations that seem dire. But they need that again right now.
Okay, you've referenced the ground balls from Eric Hosmer a couple of times, and Rustin Dodd pointed that number out to us last weekend when he was on, that in terms of just ground ball percentage. It's about 60% of the time, I think 59%, that he's hitting ground balls. I was surprised to see that number was the case last year, which was the highest of his career, because that also was the year he posted his career high for home runs and RBIs. what do we think is leading to this? And obviously, it sounds like you think it's a pretty big concern that this trend is continuing.
I do. All right, so I just looked up this number.
Okay, you got the numbers?
I'll wait that.
Let's do those first, and okay. Then we'll get back to Hosmer.
So it's 59 runs the day, if I have the day right, that they are worse. If I have the day right that George Brett was hired in 2013, they had scored 59 runs in their last 18 games. The Royals right now have scored 46 runs in 18 games. So they've been demonstrably worse. And now some of that in 2013, they scored 11 in one game. So it was bunched up a little bit. But still, that was 13 fewer runs that they've scored this year. I do think that this Eric Hosmer, that the ground balls is a big problem. And actually, there's going to be a column that's going to post very soon this morning, sort of focusing on this. And Eric Hosmer's ground ball rate is higher than any other man who hits in the middle of an American League lineup. He is a 6'4", strong, talented first baseman who repeatedly hits the ball on the ground like a leadoff hitter. He has hit the ball. I kind of pulled this out in the column because I just thought it was interesting. The second hardest, maybe somebody entering the games yesterday, the second hardest ball hit in all of Major League Baseball this season was by Eric Hosmer. And when it was ground out. It was a ground out to short. One person out of 13,000 balls have been put in play, and one person has hit it harder than Eric Hosmer did, and it was a ground out. And his batting average, like all batting averages, skyrockets when he gets a ball in the air. And there's, I think that there is some recognition within the organization that this is a way for him to be more productive, to drive in runs. But he is a guy who has a certain swing, and he doesn't have an uppercut. I heard you and Brian McCray were talking about this. It is kind of a, I don't know if it's necessarily like literally a down plane swing. I don't think that's true. But he does pound the ball into the ground at times. And the problem, once you get to a certain point in your career, Major League Baseball is so driven by the players, and a coach cannot get a guy to change that on his own unless he's all bought in. And, J.D. Martinez is often pointed to as a guy who changed his swing plane, got the ball in the air more, and went from a guy who was DFA'd by the Astros to a really, really productive hitter the last three seasons. But he got DFA'd. He had nothing to lose. Eric Hosmer hit 25 home runs, drove in 104, has been an all-star, is the face of a franchise that had a parade a couple years ago. He's not going to completely change that. And, if he is, Mark Grace and Keith Hernandez and not, David Ortiz and, Albert Pujols or whatever, then that's maybe just an adjustment that the Royals need to get used to. Because I don't know that he has it in him to get the ball in the air a lot more than he's doing right now.
I mean, he is Mark Grace, Keith Hernandez, right? I mean, like, I love Eric Hosmer. And I'd throw like maybe a Wally Joyner in there, someone like that.
That's
another
good name.
I love the guy. Like we all do. He's like you said, he's the face of the team that won the World Series. Yeah. And I think he's more than just the baseball player. He is the guy that's front and center every time someone needs to talk to the media during stretches like this. He was the guy on Saturday. That was kind of the apex, at least to this point, of the frustrations for him individually. And he's the guy that's standing there answering all the questions about letting the team down and all that. He's the guy that takes the microphone and addresses the crowd. Very well done in the Yordano Ventura situation. Yeah. But when it comes to the concept of him becoming a Hall of Fame type player, I'll give a nod to Soren Petro for this, because he said this 2-3 years ago that, look, he can become a really good player, but the Albert Pujols's, it was apparent pretty early, that this guy, the Albert Pujols's of the world, when they were in their prime, they didn't have these 2-month stretches where they were terrible, over and over again. And so, like, to me, I feel like the ship sailed on Eric Hosmer, the Hall of Famer, like 3 years ago, when he was 20. And that sounds harsh to say at 24 years old, because he is 27. He should be hitting the prime of his career right now, but But I just feel like that's just not who he is at this point. He's a good, solid player, but he's not a great baseball player.
And I've thought about this, and maybe that's true, but like, and maybe we've all been like holding him up to an unfair standard because, like, what you just said is interesting. The ship sailed on him being a Hall of Fame player, and then you said maybe that sounds harsh, and it's like, well.
Right.
There's not a lot of Hall of Fame
players.
There's
one, you know, in franchise history. I mean, there's one,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, he was the number three overall pick. And, you know, he has been the face of the rise. I mean, that is, as much as any other moment when they called him up from Omaha after he was hitting 435 or whatever it was, it was sort of like, you know, and I remember the guys inside the organization saying this, like, this is our moment. Like, this is where we're saying we need to win now. Like, this is it. And they called up Sal Perez, I think either the year before or later in that season. And Sal had the best debut. You know, Haas took a walk from Gio Gonzalez, and that was impressive. Lefty on lefty and all that stuff. But Sal had the most impressive debut of any of these guys. But when they brought up Eric Hosmer, it was like, you know, it was a statement for the organization about where they were going. And Haas, you're right. Like, he is the face for a lot of reasons that include on the field and off. But he is not a 320, 45 homer, you know, kind of guy. He's just, you know, he's not going to do that. And then look, like, if Scott Boras or anybody that worked for Scott Boras was on the show, they would talk about how he had 17 home runs on the road last year. So that means that he is a 35 to 40, you know, potential home run talent. But, you know, he's just as talented as Eric Hosmer is, as hard as he hits the ball, he is not the kind of guy that can just carry an offense by himself. And, you know, and especially not when he's hitting 200 like he is right now. There were signs. He had a nice line drive single to center. I think it was to center, right?
Yep.
Yesterday.
Yep.
I mean, there's maybe if you squint a little bit, there's some signs that maybe he's starting to pull out of it.
But his other base hit was a ground ball up the middle.
Yeah.
It's fine, but.
And that's like the thing about his swing too. Like, he hits the ball so damn hard that when he gets it in the air, sometimes it's that home run in Houston that went 400. And I mean, that was a bomb. That was just a line drive that went 430 feet or something like that. And you just think, just do that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think it was, I don't know if it was the 2013 season, I think it was, I was predicting a big power explosion from him going forward at that point, because I think at that time it was like his average home run distance was in the top five.
Yeah.
When he hit home runs, they were no doubters.
Yeah.
And that's part of the thing that would fly in the face of the, well, it's the ballpark that's keeping him from hitting home runs. He's not Billy Butler. Mm-hmm. You know, flying out 15 times to the base of the wall, and I realized that Billy Butler has gone on to do nothing since he left. But remember, at one time, you got the sense that, boy, if Billy Butler was playing in Camden Yards, he could have been a 35 home run guy.
For sure.
Because he had a ton of fly balls that he just didn't have the big man power.
Yeah.
He had the good swing, but the bad power. Hosmer, when he does make contact, it's like there's no ballpark that holds it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And there actually is a little bit of a cautionary tale with Butler. Again, something that I mentioned in this column. But, and look, like, there's a thousand things that are different about Eric Hosmer and Billy Butler, right? Like, starting with just look at him.
Yeah, so, right.
We all understand that. But at some point, Billy did try to hit for more power. He did try to create more backspin. He would talk about this.
Yeah.
More backspin on the ball, more loft. In his swing, and it completely backfired. When he was at his best, it was that first full season that he had where he hit 51 doubles and 22 home runs at the age of like 22. And the list, and I wrote this at the time, like the list of guys that had done that at that age, it was all Hall of Famers and like Albert Pujols, Grady Sizemore did it. Yeah. You know, a couple other like stars.
Like Edgar Martinez type territory, wasn't it? Yeah.
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 And I mean, just really impressive thing. And that's when he was at his best, but he tried to hit some more home runs. And it kind of, I mean, look, and again, there were other things going on, but it really backfired. And I think that that's part of the hesitation from Eric Hosmer, not necessarily specifically Billy Butler, but there's been other guys, you know, Billy's just a local, like, easy example. There's been other guys that have tried to, you know, recreate their swings to get more power, and it ends up backfiring. Because Eric Hosmer is a good hitter, but we all want him to be great. We all want him to be, you know, for his number to be retired, you know, assuming that he's going to be playing somewhere else next year anyway. But you know what I mean? Like, yep. to be that kind of guy. And if he doesn't have it in him, that's fine. But they need some other guys to do it, too.
Well, he's got to be pressing, too, because, I mean, I know that he cares more about the winning part, but he's costing himself some serious money right now.
Absolutely is.
In this regard. But the thing we know about Eric Cosmer is he will be great for a couple of months at some point this season. That's the track record says. Yep. That he'll have a month or two where he does look like that Hall of Famer that can carry the offense. The Royals just got to hope that it starts up pretty soon. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we will shift gears because I thought it was a very interesting piece that Sam wrote about Bill Snyder and probably the last athletics director he'll ever work for and what that relationship will be like going forward. But I also think just for K-State in general, very interesting times coming up in their entire athletics department. Back after this with more with Sam on Sports Radio 810 WHB. All right, we've got Sam Mellinger in studio, and we got the Royals out of the way first. Basically, the bottom line is the guys that are supposed to hit need to start hitting, and until they do, there's not really much that can be done about it. It's not like any more shuffling of pieces is going to change that. They just got to start hitting.
Yeah.
Right?
Start hitting, guys.
Okay, so we've got that settled. Yep, fixed. Problem solved. On to the next topic. You spent the weekend, you went up to the spring game, and you spent time around the new AD at K-State. And I thought it was a really interesting piece, what you wrote. Because, look, we'd heard a lot of rumblings about the fact that John Curry did not necessarily get along with any of his coaches.
Yeah.
That even though he was kind of considered the Bruce Weber defender, and he was the one that brought Bruce Weber there, even Bruce Weber, by the end of it, was frustrated with John Curry. And maybe that Bill Snyder was always frustrated with John Curry. So what was your takeaway after spending time up there and learning about the dynamic with the new guy?
It's a really interesting relationship that both men really need to have work. And there were other factors going on, a lot of other factors that we could talk about. But one of the things that you hear consistently from people who are close to or sympathize with Snyder about his frustrations with John Curry is that he did not feel listened to when, you know, for his case about why Sean Snyder, his son, the special teams coordinator, former All-American punter, should be the next head coach. And that is a really delicate situation for a lot of reasons, including, you know, this is the man's son. This is, we use this word too much, but with him, it fits a legendary figure. In that city, at that university, his name's on the stadium, and it should be. I mean, in a lot of ways, he built the modern version of that university in the town and all these things. Also, they've done this once before, replaced Bill Snyder retiring, and it backfired in a big way, and he came back and saved him. And, you know, so once this happens, and nobody knows, it could be. It could be after a year. It could be after 5 years. It could be, you know, it wouldn't surprise anybody if Bill Snyder coached for another 8 years, you know, just the way that he's going. But he is 77 years old, recently diagnosed with throat cancer. So this is Gene Taylor's most important decision. And he just has to come to this with respect. I talked to John Weefald, the former president, longtime president at K-State with Bill Snyder. And this was the best thing that he said to me over breakfast. It was about an hour and a half. He said, talking about Bill Snyder, he said, he's one of my best friends. And I think what Bill's looking for is respect, and he'll get it. At the end of everything, Bill wants respect. He wants to be listened to. John Weefald didn't necessarily say this, but I think what he was talking about was that Bill Snyder did not feel listened to or respected when John Curry was there. And so Gene Taylor has to make sure, whether he hires Jim Leavitt or somebody else, but that he has to make sure that Bill Snyder feels respected and listened to. It's a really delicate situation.
Is that possible? I mean, without hiring Sean Snyder, I'm sorry, we've seen this in many professions, but particularly in coaching. This is a deeply personal thing. This is a man's son. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't hire Sean Snyder, Bill Snyder's going to feel like he didn't listen to him. If it's that important to him, at the end of the day, that's I don't see how that almost seems like an impossible task. Pretend that you're listening to him about this, but hire somebody else.
Yeah, well, I think maybe the key is you can't pretend.
Or
you know what I mean? But I understand what you're saying is that you either listened to me and hired him, or you didn't listen to me because you didn't.
Right.
And, you know, but I also think, and look, I don't, I'm talking out of school here, but I would think that Bill Snyder is an incredibly, you know, just logical, reasonable man. And, you know, look, maybe some of that with all of us goes out the window when we're talking about our own kids.
It does.
But if he gives the case and Gene Taylor hears it and says, I understand what you're saying, but here's why we're going to go a different direction. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's a really delicate situation. This is the biggest, because this is the biggest hire. It'll be the biggest moment at K-State since the last time they did this. And the last time they did this, they screwed it up, and they screwed it up in a big way. And not just that Ron Prince wasn't good for the three seasons or whatever, but, you know, the secret contract and all these other things. Yep. And Bill Snyder had to come in and save their hide.
Look, it's a tough spot, because I do think that the underlying fear for a K-State fan is, are we a program or are we a coach? You know, because of, like you said, the last time they had to try to replace Bill Snyder didn't go well. But I'm just telling you, I'm not going to do it on the air because I don't want to, but I've seen multiple times where smart, rational people who are street smart and who can size up people in situations quickly have a blind spot when it comes to their own kids, mm-hmm. and they lose all of that rationality. And every person's different, so maybe Bill Snyder, but it sounds to me like if this is already such an issue, it's not the same. Because let me ask you a question. When has it worked? When has a head coach handing a program over to his son worked?
Yeah.
And I can't think of one. Now, I haven't dug into the research, but I can't think of one. I can think of a bunch of times where it hasn't worked. The best case scenario I could come up with was John Thompson III, who just now got fired, but had some good success mm-hmm. at Georgetown. But he went somewhere else first. Mm-hmm. He was a successful head coach somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And my whole take on that is, if Sean Snyder really wanted to be a head coach and do it right and win, he should have gotten a job somewhere else and proved he can coach. Mm-hmm. Because the Bob Knight handed it over to his son at Texas Tech was a disaster. And I feel like most times when you see it, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the scary part. I don't know Sean Snyder. I'm not telling you he can't coach, but I'm just asking you to tell me when it's worked.
Yeah, and not even, you know, I think this is what you're saying, but like, it's not even a statement on their ability necessarily. But, you know, gosh, like, think about if you're Sean Snyder and you are walking into that. That's a really difficult thing.
Right? Sure it is.
You're always going to be compared to your dad, and people are always going to think that's the only reason you have the job. You know, this was a conflict between your dad and the boss for a reason.
And it is the only reason you have the job. It doesn't mean you can't do the job, but it is the only reason.
And it's also complicated because from Bill's side, you can make a logical case for Sean that he's been around the program for so long. Bill, over and 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 over again, has talked about how that program is about family and people and relationships, and who has been around that program and family and relationships more than Sean Snyder, who has been better positioned to understand what Bill has been talking about for well more than a decade about why K-State built from the absolute ashes to where they are now. Who is better positioned to understand that and live that than Sean Snyder?
Jim Leavitt. I mean, that's my answer to that question.
That's
you know, he
is the most logical. I'm not making the case for Sean. I'm making Bill's case for Sean.
Yeah, I get it, but I'm just Jim Leavitt's lived all that, and he's also done it somewhere else where he built a program from scratch.
And he's got the clause in his contract and all of that stuff. Yeah, he makes a lot of sense.
How could an athletic director, if he's being objective about everything, look at Sean Snyder's resume and Jim Leavitt's resume and say, oh no, Sean Snyder's the guy for the job? That's the part to me.
Yeah.
You know, and I look, Bill Snyder is everything you said he was. We'll talk more about it. We've got to take a break. This is fascinating stuff that could shape the future of K-State for a long time. We'll take a break. More with Sam Ellinger after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB. All right. I'll say it. I don't want to name any of the other names of dads that think their kids are the best, or, you know, or have it, you know, have a blind spot when it comes to their own children. But I will tell you, there's a man by the name of Steve Buchady who doesn't think much of hardly any broadcaster he's ever listened to. He thinks of most sportscasters around the same realm that he thinks of most referees. But he is convinced that this guy on the morning show is not getting his just due, and he's the best sportscaster to ever live, you know? And you know what? I'm not getting paid enough. I'm undervalued. And you know what? Damn it. Everybody that employs me ought to feel really lucky that they've got me, you know? So
God bless them. God bless them.
And I always, you know, hey, Dad, appreciate it. Appreciate your thoughts. Anyway. And he's a, you know what? My father is a very cynical person. He doesn't usually have just this, you know, blind belief in many people. But when it comes to his grandchildren in particular, maybe even more so than his kids, I'll tell you what, son, I've never seen a kid catch a fly ball like your son. I mean, I've never seen a six-year-old catch a ball like that. Well, he's, you know, yeah. Yeah, kids catch fly balls. You know, they do. And I appreciate the support. So the Bill Snyder thing. Do you think Sean Snyder will be the next head coach at Kansas State? If you had to...
No, I doubt it. I mean, Jim Leavitt just makes all the sense in the world, you know, for some of the things that you just talked about in the last segment. He has a clause in his contract that says there is no buyout if I become the head coach at Kansas State. That didn't come out of nowhere.
Right. He didn't just like throw a dart at the dartboard.
Yeah. And look, like the administration has changed over both at the, you know, for the AD and the president since that clause was put in his contract. But still, he's got credentials. And, you know, people are going to ask questions about how he left South Florida, whatever. But the guy can coach and he knows Manhattan and he has a sense for, you know, I really, really believe this in college sports more than anywhere else, that fit matters. And you have to have the right guy in the right job. The right guy in the wrong job can be a disaster. And you can have a really great coach fail in a place because he didn't get the culture, or, you know, just wasn't a good fit. And Jim Leavitt is a proven successful Division I head coach who knows the culture at K-State and you would think would be a good fit there. Now, that's kind of the obvious one that I think a lot of people are pointing at. And I would assume that if we thought about it for a little longer, we could come up with a few other names. Now, you know, you're asking this about Sean Snyder, and I don't want to dismiss. I've heard some people at K-State, people who love K-State and want nothing more in the world than for their families to be healthy and for K-State to be successful, who believe that Sean should be nowhere near the head job in Manhattan. I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, you know, Sean Snyder has to, I assume he's a smart guy. You know, I assume he works hard. He's been around the program for so long. You know, there are some real, you know, qualities there. There's some real pluses there, but, you know, I just haven't heard anyone other than Bill Snyder make a case for Sean to be the next head coach.
And that is tough. That's troubling right there. Now, you mentioned, you know, Bill Snyder could coach for another 5 years. We don't know.
Yeah.
I will certainly never. I was very skeptical when he came back that it was going to work. And
me too.
I'll never question him again.
Yeah.
Because I was stupid.
Yeah.
For questioning whether or not that could work. He has always, I mean, even the last couple of years, he has looked old. I mean, he, mm-hmm. you know, when you just look at him on the field, he is old. He looks old. But the results show that he's fine, you know, in that regard. I mean, the teams plays well. They're the Bill Snyder teams still. Yeah. It's all the stuff that you expect from a Bill Snyder team. Seeing the pictures of him from the spring game and everything now, he looks like an old man who's battled cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see it, right? Like,
yeah.
You can see that it took a toll on him. Mm-hmm. I'm just seeing the pictures. You were there in person. How is he? Do we know how he is?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting that he watched the second half from the coach's box,
mm-hmm.
that he didn't stay on the sideline. I thought that was interesting. I don't think that's a usual thing for him. And look, like, of course, he's 77 years old and recently underwent cancer treatments. Like, I mean, whatever he wants to do is more than okay.
Yeah.
And that he's doing this much is amazing. But, you know, I asked him in the press conference after the spring game, I forgot how I phrased the question, but why did you go up there? Was that pre-planned or, you know, whatever? And his answer was, don't be curious, which to me is code for, yeah, I was tired and I needed a little bit of rest, which is totally understandable. But, you know, these kinds of things, you know, this is not a statement of his character, but, you know, these kinds of things you think about, you know, when he's about to start a season of major college football with a really good team, by the way.
Yes.
You know, they've got a real chance to win 10 games, 10, 11 games. I mean, they will probably be picked third, I'm guessing, in the preseason poll in the Big 12. And I think there's a really good case for them to be picked second, but they probably won't be because I think K-State is usually underrated in these things. But anyway, you know, they've got a really, really good team. And, you know, but those are kinds of things that you think about. And look, like, if anybody's going to beat it, he can beat it. You know, he's overcome a lot in his life and in this job. Nobody's going to doubt him. But yeah, I mean, I think that these are things that you start to think about for sure.
How about those Gunners?
Huh? That was good.
Yeah.
We needed that moment.
Yeah, it's been a rotten season.
We needed
season.
That moment.
Jake shaking his head. But it's been a rotten season for us Arsenal fans, and they won
back
yesterday
off,
in the semifinals of the FA Cup. And I'm going to be in Denver, Colorado on the FA Cup final because Sporting Kansas City play the Rapids that night. Mm. And so I've already got my establishment
there we go.
Selected. So anyway, I just had to get that in there. Great stuff, Sam. I mean, I think it's a fascinating situation, and I encourage everybody to read at the Kansas City Star. How new K-State AD Gene Taylor will work with Bill Snyder. And a piece coming up pretty soon about Eric Hosmer's launch angle.
Yeah, I actually just checked in the last commercial break. It is up on KansasCity.com right now.
Love talking launch angles with Sam Mellinger. Back. We'll see you next week. All right, pal.
All right, thank you.
All right, back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB.